This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The period of time between August and November is known as the red zone among advocates and survivors of sexual violence on college campuses, meaning more incidents of sexual violence are reported. Today, we'll talk about how incidents of sexual assault are handled by schools and find out how students are getting involved in raising awareness around the issue. But first, we're joined by Shandy Dearth, director of the Center for Public Health Practice at IU Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health, to get an update on COVID-19 in Indiana. Welcome back, Shandy.
Thank you for inviting me.
We heard at the top of the newscast here, I think we're going to just have to jump into this big story first, that the COVID-19 vaccine has been approved for children ages 5 to 11.
Yes, I'm super excited. As a mom of an 11-year-old, I've been waiting for this day, so this will be the final person in my household to get vaccinated. So it's great news that this is available now. And it's actually even available in some places starting today here in Indiana. Many other local health departments will open it up tomorrow. And by Monday, most of the providers and pharmacies who are planning to give the vaccine will be ready to gear up and offer the vaccine to the public.
Well, one of my kids just turned 12, so that was the birthday present, was the vaccine. It was before they approved this, so we couldn't wait.
No, I understand completely. I'm sure the child will appreciate it when they're older, that they were protected as soon as possible.
Yeah. Well, the funny part is my daughter actually really wanted it. So she's like, now we can do things with other people, perhaps. So is that something that folks can look forward to if they're getting vaccinated, to actually interact with others?
Yes. As a mom of an unvaccinated kid, we've still been really careful. We haven't even flown in the last 2 years because he's not vaccinated yet. And so we're looking forward to planning that first trip on a plane for a while. And just hanging out with, other people, not being quite as worried about what we might encounter when we're out in public. So we're going to be a little looser with him once he's fully vaccinated. So I'm happy that your child was open to getting the vaccine. I've got to say, my son hates needles and really, really hates needles. And even he is sick of COVID. And he said he's ready to go get it this week. He just wants it over with.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, New York is planning to vaccinate kids 5 to 11 beginning tomorrow through city vaccination sites and such. Do you know what the status is here in Indiana?
Yes. So we've got a pretty wide range of efforts out there in the community right now. So the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with the Indiana Department of Health is opening up again. So they're offering some drive-through clinic opportunities, which is great. So if you've got a kid who's a race fan, it might be a chance to take your kid there and get vaccinated. A lot of the county health departments are starting today. I know the Marion County Public Health Department will start opening up clinics tomorrow. They are offering vaccines through their district health offices and a few other sites around town. Anyone, no matter where you are in the state of Indiana, you can actually go to the ourshot.in.gov website, and you can put in your zip code and find the nearest location for your family.
I found interesting that lately it seems some of the vaccine hesitancy has shifted from folks who got vaccinated, and now they're worried about getting their kids vaccinated, thinking that if kids don't get as sick or have already gotten COVID, they don't need to get it. Can you help us dispel this myth?
Yes. So as a parent myself, I see that hesitancy because, you know, as an adult, you think, well, I'm willing to, you know, do this as an adult and make this decision. But when you're dealing with a smaller child, you know, I understand that hesitancy. But the great news is that the studies show that this vaccine is really, really effective. And although we hear a lot about kids who get COVID, they get it and they get over it, they're okay. What I want to caution everyone about is that some kids aren't okay. Some kids do have some long-term health effects. And a third of those kids who have ended up in the hospital, they didn't have any underlying health conditions. So I think a lot of parents who have a child in the household who doesn't have asthma or some other health issue, they just think, well, if my kid gets COVID, they're going to get over it, they'll be okay. And that's not necessarily guaranteed. But also, even though we're sick of COVID, this is still relatively a new disease when you look at the timeline of all the diseases that we have in the population. So we don't yet know the long-term effects of COVID on a child. So if my 11-year-old gets COVID today, I don't know if he's going to have some sort of thing pop up 5, 10, 15 years from now that could be related to COVID. I mean, we've seen that with other infectious diseases over time. We've seen how HPV can lead to cancer. We just don't know what COVID could eventually lead to. So go ahead and get your child vaccinated. If you're hesitant, I plead with you as mom first and a public health person second. Talk to your child's pediatrician, and hopefully the pediatrician can reassure you that it's the right decision for you and your child.
I'm thinking about how when it comes to getting vaccines and people being hesitant, is there anything other than talking to the pediatrician that can get them, I guess, the information that they need to make them feel like this is the right choice?
That's a great question, because a lot of pediatricians are going to be slammed with questions right now, so it might be a few days before they can get back with you. A lot of pharmacists are very well trained on the topic as well, so call up one of your local pharmacists, talk with them. Talk to another parent who has decided to get their kiddo vaccinated. Also, there are lots of videos out there through CDC and other reputable public health agencies where they're highlighting infectious disease doctors who are parents themselves, and they're talking about why they chose to get their child vaccinated. So go to that person that you trust that has that science and health background who can walk you through that. And lots of people are willing to take the time to address those issues. And that's one reason we're kind of seeing the rollout for the kid vaccines to be different than we did for the adult vaccines, because we understand parents are going to have more questions about vaccinating their child than they did about vaccinating themselves. So that's why you're seeing a lot of these vaccinations will be done through appointments at pediatricians' offices, that sort of thing, versus the mass clinics that we saw with a lot of adults. It's because we're aware that those parents are going to want to talk with the healthcare provider before making that final decision. And that's fine. I just encourage everyone to be patient too, because, you know, a lot of us are really chomping at the bit to get our kiddo vaccinated as soon as possible. And so we expect kind of a surge in the next few days as people are calling health departments, pediatricians' offices, that sort of thing. But trust us, we've got lots of vaccine for your kiddos. You can get in, you can get that done.
The toddler years can be pretty tough as it is having toddlers, but being in a pandemic with toddlers and not being able to go out and do things, is there any information on children under the age of 5 when they may seek the emergency use authorization?
Yes. So we do expect more data from that study age group to come out towards the end of this year, beginning of next year. So hopefully like late winter, we could possibly see some vaccinations available for the younger crowd. And I feel for anyone who's been at home with a toddler during this. That's been my one saving grace, is at least my kids were older. Yeah. But I really give kudos to those parents who have survived COVID with the toddler at home.
That is a heroic feat to accomplish.
Yes. Yep, absolutely.
When it comes to COVID here in Indiana, how are the numbers looking so far? Are we doing better or worse than you expected at this point?
So we have been declining for a few weeks, which is great. Unfortunately, what we're seeing now these last few days is that we're starting to plateau. So we're flattening out. So that decline is stopping. We aren't seeing it go up yet, but we won't be surprised if it starts to climb again, just because it's getting colder. People are going indoors. All of the schools are now back from fall break. We kind of expected a bump after fall break, just because we saw that bump after spring break earlier in the year. And so we're keeping a close eye on that, especially in that K through 12 age range, just to see what happens. And again, as people go indoors and the masks are coming off indoors, we're worried about some more transmission.
Mm-hmm. And with the holidays coming up, I'm sure a lot of people want to gather with family and friends. Is there a safe way to do that?
Yes. Yeah, so I know last year we said, please just stay home with your household family members, but we didn't have vaccine available yet at that point. This year, we can approach it a little bit differently. So at this point, we can say, go ahead and gather in small family gatherings with your vaccinated family members. So if you've got, you know, a lot of people who are vocal about not getting vaccinated, you might want to try and break up your gatherings into some smaller groups. But also, if you can, again, being outside is great if you're with some unvaccinated family members. So if it's something where you could set up tables outside in a garage, on a deck, that sort of thing, ventilation is great when it comes to COVID. But try and keep it small, especially if you think you might have an unvaccinated person in the group, just so that you're limiting transmission. And, you know, talk with your elderly parents, your grandparents, make sure that they've got their booster shot that's available.
Yes. And let's talk about that real quick. Before I forget, we do need to talk about the booster shots. How can folks get those, and how important is it to get one?
So especially for the older populations, we've seen it can be pretty important, because immunity is deteriorating over time, especially as people get older. So the booster shot helps boost that immunity again. And the Indiana Department of Health has come out and said, look, if you want to get a booster shot, go ahead and go get one. So it's still available for free at all of the pharmacies where you would have gone to get your first or second dose. the health department still have it available. You can go into any local health department in the state and get that booster dose. And it's highly recommended. There's no reason not to get a booster dose. I know it says, the guidance will often say, if you're in any of these categories, you should consider getting a booster dose. But what we've seen is anyone with any kind of immune compromised system might be at a higher risk. And as we learn more about the disease, they keep adding more conditions onto that list. So if you think you might want to get a booster, just go ahead and get it. We've got plenty of vaccine available. It's not going to hurt you to get a booster. So just go ahead and do that. And that way, you know, you've got that little bit of immunity boost as you head into the holidays and you're around those family members.
Right, right. And I'll say I did get my booster shot and I didn't really have much of a reaction, just felt a little tired. So it's not scary.
Yeah. Well, and that's a great point. And that's another great point, actually, to share about the kid boosters. So what they saw in the study when they were looking at the younger age group, the 5 to 11, is those kiddos were not reporting the kind of, you know, effects that we adults were seeing after that, say, second or third dose. Mm-hmm. And so the kids were more likely to report, if anything at all, just being tired or maybe a bit of a headache, but not nearly to the extent that we saw the adults. So it's another reason to go ahead and consider getting your kid vaccinated. Go ahead and get that first dose in before Thanksgiving. How great would that be?
Yeah, that would be awesome to start the new year with a lot of folks vaccinated, and maybe we can get back to a little bit of normalcy.
Yes, I think we're all hoping for a very different 2022.
Yeah, definitely. Before we let you go, is there anything we should be concerned about moving forward with COVID, or are things kind of in a solid place right now?
I still encourage everyone to go ahead and get their flu vaccine as well. I mean, we still have pretty high transmission of COVID, even though the numbers are going down. We're not at a great spot yet. I'm not comfortable where we are right now, especially as it gets colder and we go indoors. But also, there was so much more campaigning around getting your flu vaccine last year. I haven't seen as much of that this year. It's still just as important to get your flu vaccine this year. We don't want to overload the healthcare system. Go ahead and get that flu vaccine. And that way, if you have the flu vaccine and you start to feel sick, if you really do have the flu, you're a lot less likely to be hospitalized. So just protect yourself, get that COVID booster, and go ahead and get that flu vaccine as well.
Thank you so much. Shandy Dearth is the director of the Center for Public Health Practice at IU Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. After a quick break, we'll talk about how incidents of sexual violence are handled on college campuses. If you have questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soap. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. Around 50% of sexual assaults on college campuses are reported this time of year. Advocates for victims call it the red zone. Today, we're talking about how these incidents are sometimes handled by the school and what students should know about the process. We're joined now by Stephanie Gamble, director of the Office of Equal Opportunity and Title IX at Indiana State University, to find out what the process is like at ISU. Welcome to the program, Stephanie.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is a Title IX coordinator before we get into more details here?
So Title IX is a 1972 federal civil rights law. And I always like to share that here in the state of Indiana, we have some pride of ownership because former now deceased U.S. State Senator Birch Bayh was really instrumental in drafting, lobbying, and getting this passed. So next year, we'll be celebrating the 50th anniversary. Title IX is a federal law that prohibits gender-based discrimination in education. And all institutions, K through 12 and higher ed, are required to identify their Title IX coordinator and communicate that information to their campus community. So we have a role of sharing the compliance information. What is Title IX? Specifically, the gender-based discrimination, which includes sexual harassment as a component of gender-based discrimination. And the regulations specifically include sexual assault, dating violence, domestic violence, and stalking within those prohibitions.
And so how does this play out into what's going on at college campuses? How would you say Title IX works with incidents of sexual violence on college campuses?
So we again, as I mentioned, it's a compliance component, but we do educational programming and information sessions to communicate our expectations as a university to our college campus about what's prohibited. We discuss consent, healthy relationships, bystander intervention, how you report incidents, how incidents will be responded to once they've been reported, and then supportive services that are available to everyone on the campus. So it's a lot of programming and education. And then when we do receive reports of or complaints of an alleged violation, we are tasked with the role of investigating those allegations.
And so it wouldn't go to law enforcement. You would investigate first.
That's a great question. So this is Title IX is an administrative process, but it's very possible the same single incident could be both a university policy violation and a crime. And so individuals have the ability to report that same incident to their university and to law enforcement. And it's actually one of my roles to make sure that people who've been involved in one of these incidents know that they have the ability to report to both locations. Now, when law enforcement is involved, we kind of slow down our process a little bit so that we allow law enforcement to conduct their investigation. We don't want to do anything to interfere with that process. But the complainant, that's how we identify the person making the accusation here on college campuses, has the ability to make decisions about where they want to report and if they want to report to law enforcement.
Are there any misconceptions or misunderstandings about Title IX that people often have?
Well, so I think if you were to ask people on the street that maybe aren't affiliated with education or higher ed, if you ask them what's Title IX, I kind of joke, I think their response would be, oh, it's that law that lets women play sports in college. And that absolutely is a component, but it really allows equal access to all aspects of the educational experience, all programs and activities.
It's interesting you say that because I think that's probably what I had in mind. Just thinking back to college days, that's the first time I ever heard about Title IX. And I thought it had to do with sports and how the distribution between gendered sports was and who got what. Does that play a factor at all in deciding what sports get to be played on campus?
Yeah, there absolutely is an evaluation of equality within the sports programs. And there's different buckets that we look at, participation, scholarships. We look at the entire program. And I think if you look at other institutions during COVID, you may have noticed that there were some institutions that were cutting programming, and some of that programming specifically affected the women's programs. And so there was definitely some litigation and some complaints about parity in representation in the athletic program. So yes, that absolutely is a component.
And Title IX, that affects both men and women, correct? It's not just something to make sure girls get to play sports.
All genders. Okay. All genders are protected under Title IX.
When it comes to sexual assault and Title IX, because we are talking about that today, how is a typical process of reporting an alleged assault at Indiana State University look like? If someone wanted to go and talk to somebody about something that might have happened, is there a process they have to go through?
Absolutely. And it's pretty mechanical. I will tell you that on our particular campus, it's not really often that the complainant directly comes to the Title IX office. On our campus, a majority of our faculty and staff members are considered responsible employees, meaning they're mandatory reporters. So if they hear of, learn of, know of an incident of a Title IX violation, they're expected to report that incident to my office. And so typically, the area that I get the most reports generated is from our residence halls. So, for example, one of our students experiences an incident of sexual assault, comes back to their residence hall, tells their friends, tells their RA, tells someone, you know, close to them. Those RAs are expected to report that information to me. Or let's say a professor or a faculty member or a trusted mentor, a student goes to them and discloses that information, they're expected to report that information to my office. And then that kind of, that starts the process. So the very first thing that we do is reach out to that complainant and invite them into our office so that we can go through our policies, our procedures, make sure that they're connected to all of those supportive services that we offer on our campus, and provide them the opportunity to give us an account in their own words what has happened, and also the opportunity to make some decisions. They don't have to make decisions right then and there. That one of those decisions might be to report to law enforcement. I feel like people have an opportunity to make better decisions when they know all of their choices. So that's that starts the process. We speak with the complainant. And then if indeed they want to participate in the Title IX process, then we, under the new Department of Education regulations, we file a formal complaint. And then the respondent, the person that's identified or alleged to have violated the policy, is given notice of the allegations. And that's really what kicks off the investigation.
Earlier, we mentioned something called the red zone. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, what it is?
Absolutely. Every presentation I present on our campus, we include a slide that discusses the red zone. And the red zone is that time on a college campus between August and Thanksgiving when a majority of the sexual assault violation allegations will come into the institution. And it kind of an interesting tidbit is this year, this academic year, 21-2022, is being described as a double red zone. And the explanation behind that is last year, due to COVID, a lot of face-to-face student activities weren't happening. Like I know on our campus in residential life, students weren't allowed to have guests in their residence halls. They weren't allowed to go from residence hall to residence hall. Fraternity and sorority life recruiting was done virtually. Most of our campus activities were canceled. Our football season was canceled. And so all of those students that were on our campus last academic year as freshmen didn't really experience a true freshman experience. And so the concern is all of those freshmen who are now sophomores will potentially be doing all those things that they didn't do as freshmen. So we may have two classes of students who might be contributing to that red zone.
And when you say the red zone, so you generally, when you see it in the fall, it's freshmen, people who are new to campus that may not know consent and things like that, and get into some really scary situations. Is there anything being done to get rid of this red zone? I guess what I'm wondering is if it's a known thing that happens every year at this time, what's being done to combat it?
So you did make a point that that is absolutely accurate. A majority of our complaints do come from our underclassmen, from our freshmen. So we try to penetrate that population with as much information as possible. So I have three teenagers, and my role as their parent is to let them know what the rules are and what my expectations are of them. And so really that's our role here. Our responsibility is to make sure that our students know what our policy is, what our expectations are. And so we have so many great partners on our campus. We get involved in new student orientation. We partner with anytime there's, we have a like a Sycamore Speedway where we have just resource tables. We set up tabling events where our students are so that we can pull them in and share this information. We started a program. Our deputy Title IX coordinator, Courtney Barrett, identified that really face-to-face education a lot of times is more impactful than maybe an online learning module or directing someone to a website to read the policy. So we've partnered with our university college, and faculty members invite us into freshman classes. And Courtney gets 50 minutes with all of those freshman classes where she can discuss consent and what's a healthy relationship, what are signs of an unhealthy relationship. And then that really sticky conversation of bystander intervention, like when you see something happening or you perceive something that doesn't seem right, how can you as an outsider intervene and maybe deflect or prevent? And then also she reviews the reporting processes and all those supportive services that we have available on our campus. So we get FaceTime with new faculty members. We are at every new employee orientation, and then every opportunity that we can to meet with our students, we're there.
Is there anything being done on the flip side of this, though? I mean, I think it's great to educate and give folks the tools that they need. But let's say you do have all the tools and something still happens. What is being done to prevent the perpetrator in the first place? Is there anything, any kind of, I don't know. I don't know what you would do.
So there have been countless studies on risk factors, CDC, there's just so many journal articles. And I think as a Title IX coordinator, I would be naive and remiss to not identify alcohol as a risk factor. And so we absolutely are having those conversations about drinking and its role in sexual assault. And so that I think that's a really important conversation that we need to be having on college campuses.
And speaking of those conversations, are you seeing students more involved at ISU in tackling this issue of sexual assault?
So here at ISU, we actually have in the city of Terre Haute in Vigo County in November, there's a Take Back the Night program. And there's actually a class on campus where the students spend a large portion of that class planning that event. And so that's really kind of a highlight in our community. We have peer mentors. We have students that are getting involved to serve as peer mentors. And our student counseling center this year actually initiated a support group for survivors of sexual assault.
What do you think needs to be done moving forward to stop sexual assault from happening on college campuses, aside from educating, risk factors, all of that? Is there any, I mean, online classes, like what can be done?
Oh, you might have set me up to get in trouble. I feel like we need to do a better job with our younger population, K-12. We need to be having these conversations at a younger age. We can't expect students to come to college as 18-year-olds and it be their first time hearing about sexual assault or consent or no means no and yes means yes. We need to start earlier. And we also need to teach people to respect boundaries, that's an important component of consent.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree. I think I didn't know a lot when I went to college, and watching what they're teaching kids now in schools, I'm like, wow, aren't they too young? But I guess it's never too young.
No, I don't think it is. And we even try to practice consent. Like if I do a presentation and I'm going to call on someone in the area that seems like they would be willing to participate, I will ask, would you agree to participate in this conversation? You know, we're practicing asking consent in all of our interactions. We have medical students and we have that conversation with them. When you have a patient, you need to let them know what's happening and make sure they're consenting before you begin a treatment. It's just it's a courtesy and it should be a requirement.
Well, thank you so much, Stephanie. It's been a pleasure to have you on. Stephanie Gamble is the director of the Office of Equal Opportunity and Title IX at Indiana State University. We'll be back after a quick break to learn about student activism around sexual violence on campus. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're discussing sexual violence and how it's handled on college campuses. In the last segment, we talked about how incidents are reported and handled at one specific school, Indiana State University. Now we'll learn about the role students play in raising awareness around the problem. We're joined now by Catherine Scher, president of Sigma Psi Zeta, a multicultural sorority at IUPUI. Thank you for joining us, Catherine.
Yeah, hi. Thank you so much for having me here today.
Catherine, how big of an issue is sexual violence on your campus?
I think it's personally, I think it's as big of an issue as it is on any campus, because when you have so many students together, especially students who maybe just now coming out of living with their parents or finally moving out and being independent, they don't really know what that's like, you know? And so I think, especially on a campus that's IUPUI, where it's an open campus, anyone can pass through, and we're continuing to see all of these sexual assault reports, and not necessarily always a lot of responsiveness to it, whether that's the administration communicating that with us or they aren't doing anything. And sometimes that isn't communicated to us, you know?
Mm-hmm. And how would they normally communicate? Would they send an email out to students letting them know something happened?
Yeah. So sometimes they'll send out a warning of a rape or sexual assault was just committed around this area. And there'd be an email that comes out. But even then, sometimes it's that comes out, but then there's not really a response is what are we doing to prevent those things from happening? It's just, yes. Okay. So this is happening. It can't just be this is a warning, you know, we have to do something about it.
Yeah. So it kind of leaves you feeling a little nervous, I'm sure, without mm-hmm. hearing some kind of follow up. But it sounds like the students are, and including yourself, are doing things that you can that are in your hands to do on campus. So what work do you do to raise awareness of this issue?
So my sorority, our philanthropy is Combating the Violence Against Women. So that includes whether that's domestic violence, sexual assault, interpersonal violence, the list goes on, you know. We do a lot of different kinds of workshops, educating the community and educating ourselves, obviously. How can we support survivors if we aren't aware of what those steps are? We typically hold we started holding an annual conference every year on sexual assault, during Sexual Assault Awareness Month in April. And so we do that so that people have somewhere, you know, to go to learn about these things, because you don't really know what you don't know. Recently, I organized with our undergraduate student government to do a solidarity walk, because there was a sexual assault that happened in one of our dorms. And we wanted to show support. So we did a solidarity walk / protest to raise awareness, as well as allow survivors or allies to speak up about their experience as well. So typically those kinds of things, honestly.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think it's important for your sorority to be putting on events and workshops about this?
I think, like I mentioned, is A lot of people don't know what they don't know. And if you've never had to have this kind of conversations or this kind of encounter, which I hope that people never do, but if you've never had to have that conversation, then it's such a sensitive topic when it does happen that it can almost be like this, oh, like, what am I supposed to do with this? Like, I want to support someone, but like, I don't know how. And so being able to create like workshops or resources in that sense is people can go to those things before the situation arises so that if they encounter that, then they're able to do something or they at least have like prior exposure to it so that they're like, okay, like this is a response and like I should help them in this way or how can I support them?
Speaking of the solidarity walk you did, there have been schools around the state recently mm-hmm. that have seen demonstrations by students speaking out against sexual assault on campus. How does it feel to see other students across the state working on the same issue?
I think it's very empowering. I think it's really cool to be able to see that students feel motivated enough to touch in activism in the smallest sense or in the largest sense. However that looks like for an individual. I think sometimes it's important to remember that it's not about being the biggest organization or being the biggest organizer out there, but I think it's who are you doing this for and like what do survivors need? Because sometimes I feel like when we amass a lot of people, we don't really have a direction in what we're going with that group, you know? So I think I'm empowered to see that people are doing these things, but I'm also sometimes wary to see like people continuing to speak up or if they aren't headed in the right direction, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like sometimes the cause can get watered down when it just becomes too big, maybe. Mm-hmm. And you lose the voice of what you really started out doing. Are there any concerns that you hear a lot from students when they talk about sexual violence on campus?
Yeah, I feel like a lot of times it's like when, especially because we are an open campus, like anyone can walk through our campus, is like, what does safety look like? Whether that's, we now recently have like our blue lights working again, so if like a student is needing help, like they can push those buttons. But I know some individuals like aren't safe, like for example asking like IUPD to walk with them, because we do have a safe walk program, but then there are students who may be not comfortable with like police or authority figures in that sense. So mm-hmm. then it's like what are those students supposed to be able to ask for? Also like walking at night can be like dangerous when we're like right next door to like the urban city, you know?
Mm. I'm kind of confused about that, but I don't live in that area, so I'm not sure.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yes. IUPUI is like part of like the Indianapolis area. So we're like very much in the downtown area. People are able to like, people pass our campus a lot, like whether they are students or whether they're not students. And that's just the nature of our campus.
Yeah. When it comes to people talking about this issue, mm-hmm. I'm just thinking from my own self, I'm going to make myself sound old, but from my own college days to now, I see that it's a lot more open. People are discussing things, trying to come up with solutions. Do you feel like it's that open?
I think it depends on who you talk to, because I think there are definitely people who are a lot more empowered to talk about it, whether that's a result of seeing more people speak up in the media in general, or just the availability of resources potentially, or organizations working towards these efforts. But I don't want to speak for all like survivors or all individuals surrounding it, because there are definitely probably people who still don't feel comfortable talking about that, and we don't hear about them because they aren't talking about that. Whether that's because they aren't comfortable with it or because they don't feel like it's safe enough to talk about it. So I think that's like a hard question to answer, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I guess people have different levels of feeling safe about opening up. But I guess what I mean in general is just the topic of sexual assault, talking about a consent, all of these things mm-hmm. that, to me, when I look back at my school years, I don't remember this kind of stuff being talked mm-hmm. about openly. And it seems like there's a lot of programming. You have your sorority doing things. Mm-hmm. So do you feel like it's pretty open, or there's more that can be done?
I always think there can be more to be done. I think even if we hold these programmings, is like, are the right people coming to the events as well? Are we having those conversations with people that maybe it's the fraternities that we need to have these conversations with, but we don't see them show up as often to these workshops or these conferences or these events. So it's open. I think people aren't afraid to talk about these things for the people who are comfortable talking about it. But I think the struggle still is the message getting across to the people who need to get that message.
And you mentioned students may not always feel safe. Do you feel safe on mm-hmm. campus?
I think I personally, not always. I think I try to, I always walk with other people, or even if someone is like walking alone, I'll walk with them too, or I'll make sure they get into a building first. It's like hard. I don't know. I feel like, okay. I personally have never had anything happen to me on campus, but because of everything that I've heard about or that I've seen, it's like, I always feel like I have to take a precaution in case something were to happen. So is that really feeling safe? I probably wouldn't say so, but
yeah, I mean, it's good to always be aware of your surroundings, I think. But when it comes to, you mentioned fraternities mm-hmm. aren't always so involved. There's a stereotype, obviously, with Greek life that fraternities are party places and things happen. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like this is a stereotype that you have to constantly dispel?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Do you feel like there's a stereotype around Greek life that you have to keep pushing against?
Yes, 100% yes. I think there's a certain idea of Greek life that exists in media and like just general perception that like it's like only for partying or you're paying for friends or all of that stuff. And as someone who really sees the value in like being in a multicultural space and being able to work with other people of color in all of these efforts that we do, I think it's hard to, when we say sorority, people automatically think, oh, so like partying. And I definitely don't ever feel like I am only partying on the weekends. I'm doing like work, like we have like an activism chair, a cultural educational chair. And people don't always see that side of Greek life, I feel like.
Yeah. When it comes to the work that you do with through your sorority, mm-hmm. Do you feel like it's getting the proper recognition?
I think in the recent years, it has gotten more recognition than it has in the past. Multicultural Greek life is a little bit younger, so sometimes it's hard for people to be like, oh, like, what is this? Or differentiating between typical, like, college Panhellenic and, like, the national Panhellenic or sororities and fraternities and, like, the multicultural sororities and fraternities. But I think in, like, the recent times, at least at IUPUI, like, I feel like we've been getting more recognition, I think, as a result of, like, working and doing bigger things on campuses, and we've won a few awards now at this point. So I think people like have started to take us more seriously, but I think there was like a level of like, oh, need for like validation to be like, oh, like, okay, so they are doing stuff.
Mm-hmm. I know that in the past there have been conversations about abolishing fraternities and sororities on campus. Have you heard of any of that going on? Is that a possibility?
I haven't heard about it specifically on IUPUI's campus, but I have heard about it from other like Greek sororities and fraternities on other campuses, as well as I know on a federal level, there's always kind of the fight for keeping like Greek life on campuses. I don't remember which university it was, but they were basically saying that like if you're involved in Greek life, you couldn't get a like letter of recommendation. And so it was kind of like pushing people away from Greek life because it's like your academics are obviously more important than your social like student organization things. So I have heard of it. I haven't heard of it specifically on the IUPUI campus though yet.
How much of a difference do you think it would make if Greek life was gone from campuses? Would it be positive? Would it be negative?
I feel like it can definitely be both. I think people do take good things out of Greek life, but there's also a lot of like people don't join Greek life for the right reasons. And instead it brings them down where it's like, oh, like they're partying consistently or like we're not educating about like sexual assault well enough, or they're just in it for like the popularity. And I think at that point, then it's like, it would be for the positive. But then if you think about the multicultural spaces we're creating for people of color who maybe haven't always been able to feel comfortable in these spaces, like are historically Black fraternities and sororities, those are good spaces for them to be able to have that home or have that space, or even like multicultural sororities and fraternities where there's Latinx orgs or there's my org, which it's like multicultural, so anyone's allowed to be in the space, or there's South Asian spaces. So I think it also like is like, what reasons are we in Greek life for?
Well, before we wrap up, what do you think would help students feel more safe on campus?
I think help creating more spaces where survivors feel like they can come forward, or making the process of coming forward easier, or not having to face your assaulter consistently. I also think communication between like admin and the student body of like, what are they doing for these issues could be better. I think sometimes students are left in the dark and it feels like that administration isn't doing anything. And then sometimes I'll talk to administration and they'll be like, oh, we're doing this. And then I'll be like, okay, so then why doesn't all of the student body know that this is happening?
So better communication sounds like needs to be done. Well, I want to thank you so much. Catherine Scherer is the president of Sigma Psi Zeta, a multicultural sorority at IUPUI. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.